My dear brethren and sisters, it's nearly traditional amongst us that the word of exhortation is the only address that we give which hasn't got a title, which hasn't got a subject. There are one or two special occasions when a word of exhortation is given and the subject is asked for, but in general, you never find this on a plan. I wonder, therefore, perhaps, that a word of comfort and encouragement this morning might come from the words of Jesus, and perhaps when we read those words again, we might seek to remember some word of consolation. Reach hither thy hand. The thoughts really came from the wonderful reflections of the psalmist that we were thinking about during the week, particularly when the psalmist had spoken about ascending into heaven and finding God there, making a bed in hell and recognizing that even there was God, seeking to go even on the wings of the morning to the uttermost parts of the earth, and even there, the Lord is, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. One's mind goes back to the early history that we are given in the Word of God that we have been reading of recently, thinking particularly perhaps about the problems that were facing Jacob, thinking of the deceit which had gone on in that household when apparently the purpose of God had been changed. Deceit which had changed hands, which had changed the smell of raiment, but the voice was the voice of Jacob's. And when all this came to light, it became obvious that Jacob wanted to get away from the wrath and anger of his brother, and guided by the counsel of father and mother, he left his countryside and went out to Padan Aram. As far as the record is concerned, it looks very much as though Jacob went quite alone. It looks as though there was no one with him until he lighted upon a certain place at night, at the end of what must have been a very difficult journey, with all the emotional disturbance of mind. He came to this quietness. We've seen pictures of those recently who've been out into the land and have shown us the barrenness, the brown sand and the rocks and the boulders, the isolation of it all, and to this place came Jacob, and tired by the journey and concerned by the problems that were his, he took one of the stones that it might become a pillow for him for the night, and he sank into deep sleep. It was one of those sleeps which was disturbed by the vision that he had there, the ladder which was joining heaven and earth, the angels of the Lord ascending and descending, and in that startling feeling that we so often have when our visions of the night are disturbed, Jacob recognized where he was. Surely God is in this place, and I knew it not. We might have thought that Jacob would have known that there was no place where God is not. We might have thought that in the early training of this man from father and mother, he would have known of what we like to speak about today as the omnipresence of God. The fact that there is no place that we can pinpoint and say, there, God is not. There was an ancient map shown of some particularly difficult parts of the sea, And on the map there had been shown pictures in the water of fishes and of rocks and of temptresses, and each of these were indicated on the waters on the map. It was a place of great danger, but someone had written amongst all these, "Here is God." The world has an unfortunate phrase, you know, and I know you'll pardon its use here just to emphasize the point I have in mind. The world uses a phrase, a God-forsaken place. There is no such thing as a God-forsaken place. And yet, brothers and sisters, although we give acclamation to the basic truth that we believe, although we use lovely words like omnipresence, omniscience, and think about the all-powerful nature of God, is there, in all honesty, a place in our lives where God is not? Is there a place where we might be surprised and recognize, as Jacob recognized, surely God is in this place, and I knew it not? It's not a question of just meeting God here week by week. It's not just a question of thinking about God as we take our Bibles out to do our daily readings. But it's a question of the Lord going with us wherever we may go, that whatever task we are fulfilling in office, in factory, in school, in workshop, no matter where, there is no place where God is not. And although the great prophets had many lessons to learn, although Jonah thought that all he had to do was to catch a boat that would take him away from God, the basic truth that we have revealed here is that God is all present, wherever we may be, whatever we may do. And if we're doing it, let's make sure that we're doing it indeed as unto the Lord. Forty years, you know, is a long time in anyone's life. It was 40 years since Moses had slain the Egyptian and the Israelite. It was 40 years since he left Egypt and had gone to seek out in the wilderness Jethro and had sought to tend his flocks. And there must have been a growing frustration in the mind of Moses. The man who apparently had started so well, the man who had recognized that he was surely part of the purpose of God, and yet for 40 years he had spent tending sheep, flocks, taking them around in the wilderness from place to place. Many days spent under the heat of the eastern sun. Many days spent trying to find water. Many days spent in the wilderness journey. Sometimes the heat of the sun produced a fire in the bush, the trees that burnt and quickly charred and died, a common sight. But this time, the bush had been burning for a long time. It wasn't the normal phenomena. This was different. And the curiosity of Moses was directed towards this burning bush, and gradually coming close to it, he was suddenly halted in his path. "Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." There didn't look to be much holy ground on the place on which he stood. The chemist could have analyzed the soil and it would have been the same as the soil in all the other parts. The place whereon thou standest is holy ground. There was a question asked, you remember, by the woman of Samaria to Jesus as to where indeed should we seek to meet God, in this mountain, or shall we do it in Jerusalem? And Jesus said, you know, the time is coming when the Father is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. And we sing together, wherever, Lord, thy people meet, there they behold the mercy seat. Where'er they seek thee, thou art found. And every place is hallowed ground. Is our home hallowed ground, brothers and sisters? It seems a little time since I saw the sign in some of the homes that we used to see quite common at one time, that Christ is the unseen guest of this house. The quiet listener to every conversation. The unseen guest at every meal. You find that rather naive. Do you accept, brothers and sisters, that here right now as we meet around this mercy seat, we believe sincerely that he's here in the company of two or three met in his name to bless? There's one meeting place to which I go where there's an empty chair always on the platform, and it's there unoccupied for him. But go away from these surrounds, from the fellowship of our brethren and sisters. Go into our homes, into our work. Is it indeed hallowed ground? Or are these just platitudes? Or are they things that mean things in our lives? That will make people realize that we have been with Jesus. Yes, been with Jesus. It was true that when those words were uttered, they had in fact literally been with him. You believe that when we go from these rooms this morning, we have been with Jesus and have accepted his invitation to come ye apart a while. And let the politicians of the earth carry on with their raging. Let the men who seek to put this world right carry on with their statements. Let us come into the presence of one who can give to us peace, not as the world knows peace, but when the days come when there will be a quietness amongst the nations, and when the last manifesto will have been established, when we shall recognize that this is our God, in whom we have served and have believed. We go down the years and we come to the prophet Elijah in the seventh heaven of delight, glorious on the mountain top at Carmel. The fire from God had devoured the very sacrifices now. Even the water in the trench had been licked up, and the fire had devour the sacrifice. The great name of the God of Israel had been justified, and the prophets of Baal had been slain. But how quickly in life do we come from mountain tops into valleys? How quickly do we descend right down to meet, yes, even Jezebel? Thy life be like unto one of theirs, she said, and if not, then let the gods do so to me. And recognizing that this was the pronouncement of this evil woman, this man of God left his servant in Beersheba and he went to try and find a place of quietness. He went into the wilderness to get away from it all. to find a place where he might die, for he was not one whit better than his fathers. And in that strange quietude which there seems to be in that part of the earth, he sought out a cave, and into the cave he went. "What doest thou here, Elijah?" I wonder often how those words were uttered. You can try this out at home quietly. There are many ways in which you can express those words. "What doest thou here, Elijah?" It can be surprise, it can be disgust, astonishment, sympathy, comfort. I wonder in what way God spoke thus to the prophet. I wonder in what way he might have spoken to us during the week that's passed, and everyone knows the answer to this one. "What doest thou here?" Wherever that here might be. It's well that we remind ourselves, brothers and sisters, that we are always in the presence of God. We can't go and find a cave in Horeb and think we have got away from God. We have vowed that all that he has said we will do and be obedient thereto, and we seek to follow him. But you know, the children of Israel found this very difficult. It wasn't easy for them to think about God being everywhere present. And we are just like the children of Israel, you know. We are sensual individuals. We seek to know by our senses, by our touching, by what our eyes can see, what we hear. And people played very much upon the sensibilities of the children of Israel. When in Dan and in Beersheba they built golden calves, and they said, "Never mind going to Jerusalem. These are they that brought you out of the land of Egypt. These be thy gods, O Israel." And they sought after the things that they could see and touch and handle. They couldn't conceive of God being everywhere present. They might listen to those who told of here in the tinkling bell as the high priest wandered through the place, the holy place. They might hear of those who had listened to find out whether God would be pleased, as from the Shekinah glory there was the radiated power of God. But to the ordinary man in the street, this was very difficult indeed. And that's one of the reasons, why 1900 years ago there was wandering about Judea and Galilee the Son of God, whom, as John says, our eyes have seen, we have touched, we have handled. This wasn't a theological exercise. This wasn't worship in abstract. This was taking hold of the Son of God. His name shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. We're not going to get into difficulties upon the strange views and doctrines of the Trinity. This doesn't come into it at all. It's simply a question that when one came to Jesus and said, "Show us the Father," Jesus said, "He that has seen me hath seen the Father." It was this understanding that here was one who manifested the power and the attributes of God. But it came down into the very humblest of homes, the realization that now was someone they could think about, that they could talk about. There was the woman who was so symbolic of every man, who for years had been troubled by a grievous disease, And all that she had been spent on the physician, and she was not one whit better. But in her heart, she said, if I can but touch the hem of his garment, I shall be cured. It was this realization, brethren and sisters, that there was one to whom you could go, who was touched with the feelings of our infirmities, who could understand the problems of human life, so that in your heart you said, if I can but touch the hem of his garment. And this is why, at even ere the sun was set, they brought to him so many sick and troubled, both in body and in mind. Oh, in what divers pains they met. Oh, with what joy they went away. And therefore people began to realize that this is what it meant to be associated with the things of God. Sometimes, of course, they were overexcited. Peter left the boat there because he could see his master coming on the water, and quickly faith left him, as faith has a habit often of leaving us. O thou of little faith, wherefore dost thou doubt, said Jesus, as he put forth his hand to save the perishing Peter. But it was never better exemplified than in the case of the classic doubter of all times. What a thrill it must have been on that first day after the resurrection, when Jesus met with his disciples to do just what we are going to do now. But Thomas wasn't there. The life of Thomas was surrounded by all the feelings which and experiences which go together to make life. He wasn't used to seeing a man who'd been crucified back in the midst of them, and he doubted. He doubted even the words of his brethren. It's a terrible thing to doubt, you know, brothers and sisters. To wonder whether we are right. To wonder, as those who went to Emmaus wondered, we trusted that this had been he. And there was surely honest doubt in the mind of this man, Thomas. But on the next first day of the week, the gracious words of Jesus came to the community, peace be unto you. And then directed towards Thomas, Thomas, reach hither thy hand. And the hand of the doubter went forth towards the hand of his Lord. And there was a recognition that this was none other than his Lord and his God, and from that came a blessedness to all doubters who from that time forward have wondered, but more than that, having wondered, have recognized that this indeed is their Lord and their God, who having not seen, yet they believe. And so it was that the gospel was preached to mankind, not now of a God who was omnipresent, although that still operated, not now of a God who was very difficult to think about, but now of his Son, Jesus Christ, who had brought so much hope and comfort and consolation into the midst of the ordinary folks, so that the common people heard him gladly. And this is the Jesus that we have come to remember this morning, brothers and sisters. This is the Jesus that we have come to think about. Are there times in our lives when the problems that we have seem insurmountable? Are there times in our lives when it feels as though no one is concerned with what we're doing or what we're thinking about? this is the time to recognize that he knows all about us, that he can help us through all the changing scenes of life. He'll never leave us nor forsake us. He'll never let us down. He's the one that will stand by right to the end. But sometimes with doubt and frustration and anxiety, we grow tired of recognizing this. And sometimes we find a place in which we think God is not. A place where the ground is not holy, as we think. When perhaps the voice of God is silent and we hear no one saying to us, "What doest thou here?" Brethren and sisters, in circumstances like that, let's get back to the good old book, the good old story that's comforted us so many times, quietly waiting until his son shall be back in the earth, realizing that through all the changing scenes of life, there is no circumstance, no situation into which he cannot come to help. There's neither the joy of strength nor the sadness of weakness. There's neither the pleasure of fellowship nor the quietness and silence of loneliness. There's neither the excitement of youth nor the reflection of age. There are none of these things into which he cannot come and can say to every one of us, as in fact he says to us now in these emblems before us, with all the comfort and understanding sympathy which is, "Reach hither thy hand